It's good to be here tonight, and the topic and the theme for the whole summer is really looks great, and I hope you'll be uplifted by it and encouraged. But the question that we want to consider is, am I become your enemy, or have I become your enemy because I believe there's a God? There are people who are skeptics, there are people who are agnostic, there are people who are atheists, who absolutely hold with contempt what you have embraced for your life and for your way of life. I remember, have you ever entertained thoughts of doubt? What if I am wrong? What, I mean, there are so many people and so many educated people who think otherwise, and what if I'm wrong? I remember as a young boy laying in bed at night, and I was entertaining these thoughts about eternity and God, and it's hard to get your arms and your mind around the vastness of God and always being and not being created and so forth. And I remember thinking, like, Lord, if you're really there, flip my lights off. You know, have you ever done something like that? I think it was really more born out of laziness on my part than it was to really know that God exists. But we look for evidences. We need evidences for the existence of God. And that's not found in somebody flipping your lights on or off. It's found in, it's found in nature. And it's found in his revealed will. We don't have anything to apologize for or to be embarrassed about. We don't have to cower as those who don't have any intelligence, and we're just, unintelligent and unenlightened when we come to a discussion on this topic. I remember a number of years ago, my wife and I attended a lectureship. Well, it was a seminar conducted by an atheist on the campus of Marshall University in West Virginia. And I remember as that began, there's this professor standing up, and he was advocating that there is no God. And he stood up, and he held his arms out like this and said to all the people that were present, many of them were students, wanting to hear what this man had to say. Really, he was undermining the faith of a lot of people that probably came from God-believing, Bible-believing homes. But this man stood up and said, God, if you're there, if you really exist, I dare you, strike me dead right now. And he waited, and nothing happened. He said, did you not hear me? I said, if you're there, strike me dead right now. Prove to these people that you're God. You want believers? Prove to them right now. Use me as your guinea pig. Strike me dead. And he stood there for dramatic effect for probably 2 or 3 minutes. And of course, nothing happened. And he said, see, folks, there's no God. If there was a God, surely being challenged and called out like I just did, he would have defended himself. If he wants you to be believers, he would have done something to have prevented what just took place. But the reality is, he isn't there. He doesn't exist. And I thought about that illustration that he made, and it didn't prove at all what he was trying to prove by it. He was trying to prove that God doesn't exist because there he stood alive when he called on God to kill him. No, it didn't prove that God doesn't exist. What it did prove is that God is a long-suffering, patient God. That's all he ended up proving that day. Does God exist? There are people, there have always been people who are atheists and agnostics and skeptics and they don't believe in God, but you know, they've always had this mindset of, well, you know, you believe, if you want to do that, I mean, go ahead and do that. I don't see any sense in it, but I mean, when we're dead, so I guess you can live your life how you want, and I'll live my life how I want, and when we get to the end, we'll just cease to exist. There was a passive atheism in times past, but today things are different. There's what is called a new atheism, and it's led by men like Richard Dawkins. Richard Dawkins spoke at a rally in Washington, D.C. a couple years ago. It's called a Reason Rally. And there were thousands of people present, and he was mocking and making fun of Christianity. And he called on the crowd. He said, listen, here's what you need to do. If you find a Christian, if you find a believer in God, here's what you do. Mock them. Make fun of them. Ridicule them. Hold them up to scorn and contempt in public. And boy, that was received with a rousing ovation and so forth. But the point is, the atheists that our fathers and grandfathers dealt with are not the same breed of atheists that we deal with today. We have a militant group of men and women who aren't content to just say, you know, there is no God. They have an agenda to ridicule and mock and put you down and make you look insignificant and unintelligent, uneducated. I want you to know again, as we start this lesson, that you don't have to be embarrassed to say, I believe in God. You do know that some of the greatest minds that ever lived were believers in God. I mean, that's some of the greatest scientists that have ever lived believed in the existence of God. There's no shame and there's no intellectual deficiency to say, I have faith. The Bible tells us in Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 1 that faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Faith is not a leap in the dark. God hasn't called us, you know, just because we can't see something, can't touch it, doesn't mean that, there's question about its existence. You know, there's so many things that fall into the realm of things that we can't touch or that we can't see. You know, I've never seen my great-great-great-grandfather, but I know without a shadow of a doubt I had one. Don't you? I mean, I hadn't seen him. And I haven't touched him, but I know he exists. And the fact that I haven't seen or touched doesn't in any way diminish the knowledge that I possess as to his existence. Same thing is true with God. You say you can't see God, you can't touch him, you can't feel him, therefore, you know, he must not exist, or at least your faith in him is based on a leap into the dark. No, not at all. The Bible provides us with, and God provided us with, evidences that exist in nature and that exist in his revealed will, so that it's not a leap in the dark. My faith in God is based on evidence that I have declaring his existence. I want tonight to share with you a couple arguments about the existence of God to reinforce what you already, I believe, you believe. And then I want to talk about, you know, those on the other side who say, now, we're all about reason and intellect, and you guys are inferior and, academic, you're just not, you're not with it. I want to share with you who really has the problems and who really should be embarrassed that they don't have knowledge and science on their side. Let's start, with some arguments for the existence of God. First argument I want to share with you is the argument from design. You've heard of the argument from design. Maybe you've heard of its official name. It's called the teleological argument for the existence of God. And that's a mouthful, but we can just say it this way. Every design has a designer. That's what it is in a nutshell. A couple hundred years ago, there was a man by the name of William Paley who wrote an article about the watch and the watchmaker. Do you know what I'm talking about? He used that illustration of a watch and all the complexity that goes into the fine workings, the gears, the springs of a watch. And he said, can you ever imagine anyone thinking that they see that on your wrist and they say, Where'd you get that? Oh, I don't know. I was down on the beach one day when a bad windstorm came up and just blew it together. And there it is. I mean, that's basically what he was arguing. Now, you know, I have a watch today. It doesn't have gears or anything. It's a little computer. In fact, I can do like my Dick Tracy talk into it, and I make phone calls on my watch. Now, what are the odds that would have just like a bad storm, there was stuff laying around, and everything just like blew together? Or what if I even like helped it and I put it all in a sandwich bag, sealed it up, and shook it? How long would I have to shake until that thing came together perfectly? Time will not account for design. You can wait forever, and some things are not going to happen because they require intelligence. And that's the case with the universe. Who could have designed, how else can you account for the universe? The complexity that is shown in creation, the planets, how everything works, how we're just the right distance from the sun. If we were closer, we would burn up. If we were farther away, we would freeze. The complexities of the human body, how do we account for that? Brother Warren, a number of years ago in a debate with Anthony Flew, used the illustration of a prosthetic hand. And he said, you know, you've got this hand, and it's complex. It has gears, and it has things, and the fingers can actually move on it, and it can be controlled, and you know, it's a pretty neat thing. And he asked him, could that have just come into existence on its own? And, of course, he said, no, there's no way it could. And then Brother Warren just simply said, but the human hand is so much more complex than this. I mean, it has feeling even. And the movement is so much more, fine motor skills and all this. And he talked about the circulatory system and the muscular system and all those kind of things and how that it outshined this. And then he said, did this just happen? To be consistent, he had to say, well, yeah, that just happened. But you see, that forsakes logic and reason. There's evidence, and God intended for us to have evidence for his existence in nature itself. In Hebrews chapter 3 and verse 4, the writer of the book of Hebrews actually uses this argument a long, long time ago for the existence of God. You know what he said? He said it this way. He didn't say, folks, this is the teleological argument for the existence of God. Make sure you write this down. No, he said it in terms that we can understand. He said, you know what? Every house is built by someone, and the builder of all things is God. That makes sense. Who in their right mind would go down the road and see a house and say, wonder how that got there? You would know that if there's a house, you know there has to have been a builder. Design requires a designer. And with the universe, there is so much design. Everything screams that there is a designer. Job even used the expression in Job chapter 12. And this is a poetic way of saying it. But he said, you know what? The fish, the animals that crawl on the ground, the birds that fly in the air, they all testify that God made them. And they do. They are a testimony, so much so that in Romans chapter 1, you remember what he says in verses 20 through 22, God said, those who deny me are without excuse. Because there is revealed in creation itself a sufficient evidence to say there is a God. And for people to wander around and say, I don't believe in God. They're without excuse, God said. I've given you enough evidence in creation itself, let alone the Word of God. But in creation itself, you should know that there is a creator. I like the cartoon I saw a number of years ago, and it was of two fleas having a conversation. And one flea was saying to the other, "You know, I don't think I believe in a dog." And then the next picture backs away, and they're standing on the back of a dog when they're saying it. And isn't that almost reflecting what men do? I don't believe there's a God. And we're standing on the universe and the creation and the world that He Himself had made for us. There's a blindness. Evidence from design is apparent, and there's no way to account for our existence other than to acknowledge where there's a design, there's a designer. And that's rational. To say otherwise is irrational. The second argument that we can use for the existence of God is simply called the moral argument. Where did morals come from? Who gets to say what's right and what's wrong? You see, there is within us the knowledge that there are some things that are, they're right, and some things are wrong, and we know that. And where did that moral sense of oughtness come from, that I ought to do something rather than something else? How did that get in me? Where did this come from? Is this just a human construct that we decide our own ethics? We decide that murder's wrong, but if we would have been different, we could have decided that it was okay and then it would be okay? Is that what we're saying? You see, if murder and if morals are just a matter of human opinion polls, the majority of us think that this is moral, therefore it is. If that's how we determine morality, then everything's up for grabs. Everything is up for grabs. And how do we settle that? Is it popular vote? Is it worldwide popular vote or cultural popular vote or maybe my community or maybe even my household? Who decides what's moral and what's not? If God decided, then it's universal. If man decided, it's up in the air. If there were a spider or a bug, one time I was preaching, and a guy was sitting right here in the second row, and I saw him looking intently at me while I was preaching. I didn't quite know what was going on, and he sat there, and there was a class book. You remember the Gospel Advocate Foundation class books? He rolled that thing up like this, and he got up out of his seat, and he started coming up to the pulpit like this. And I didn't know what to think about it. And he got up here, and he smacked the front of the pulpit as hard as he could and startled me. And I looked at him, and he said, "Wasp." That's all he said. But he came up to kill a wasp. Well, listen, he killed that wasp that day. Should we have fallen out with him? Who do you think you are taking the life of a wasp? Don't you know that's wrong? If we are the product of evolution, if we have no purpose, no design, no destiny, then why is our life more valuable than the value of that wasp's life? We don't get upset when we kill certain critters, but we get upset when we kill us. But why? On what basis? If ethics are just... Here's why. There is within us a sense of morality, and we know there's a difference. We know it. And again, to say, "Oh, I don't know that," that forsakes rationality and reason. We have nothing to be embarrassed for in terms of rational thinking. There's a lady whose son was a Christian. He was probably in his 30s at the time, and he had left the faith. He told his mom he was an atheist. She was terribly upset and said, can you have some studies with my son? He's willing to do it if you will." And so I said, "Well, sure." So we had a meeting, and he said, "Well, I don't believe in God I don't think there is one. I was made to go to church when I was younger, but there's no evidence for God. And I said, well, how about morality as being an evidence? He said, morality is just a social construct. It's just what we make it. And I said, oh, okay, well, let me ask you something. What Hitler did in killing the Jews, was that wrong? Now, he knew where I was going with that. And he actually said, well, why do you ask that question? I said, well, you just answer it. Was he wrong in what he did, exterminating millions of Jews and other people that he considered undesirable? If he answers that it was wrong, he knows I'm going to ask, who said so? Because according to their culture, they were doing the right thing. That was the thing of the law. That's what their law said. They could do it. And if it's a matter of right and wrong being a matter of popular decision in their culture, that was okay. In fact, the German generals and so forth, when it came to the Nuremberg trials, they tried to use that argument. We were only doing what our superiors told us to do. We were obeying our superiors, and therefore we shouldn't be held accountable. They told us to do this. But they were reminded that they were accountable to a higher law than that one that was barking those orders to them. And this man, because he knew what I was going to do with that, said, I don't know if I can say that what he did was immoral or not. Again, he forsook reason because it was going to expose the ridiculousness of his position. We have nothing to be embarrassed of. There is design in this universe that necessitates a designer. And there is this sense of morality, a sense of ought. You would not dispense of me the same way you would dispense of a wasp that is aggravating you. Because you know, and everyone knows, that there is a difference. Let me give you a few things that some who claim to be skeptics, there's an air to skepticism. You see, if you're skeptic, you can have this, we're not dogmatic, we're not haughty and arrogant. We're willing to admit we could be wrong, and there's this false sense of humility in that, and you don't have to make claims, you don't have to defend things when you're a skeptic. But let me tell you, those who have rejected God, they're the ones who have forsaken reason. Let me give you some things for you to think about before you go home tonight. Often it's the atheist who chides the believer for being uneducated and unscientific. It's quite the opposite. You just need to arm yourself with the information and to be aware it is they who have forsaken reason and education and who are unscientific. Let me give you a couple examples. The first one is called spontaneous generation. Do you remember back when you were in school? You studied this in science class. Spontaneous generation is the belief that certain things come to life. Non-matter just gives rise to matter. There was a time when people thought mice came from dirty clothes. You take these clothes and you throw it down in your basement over there in the corner, and you go back 2 days later to pick it up to wash them, and a mouse might scurry out from those clothes. Those clothes gave rise to that mouse. Foolish. There was a thought that if you left meat gave rise to maggots and flies. Did you know that? They thought that flies came from meat, but what was happening is that the flies were landing on the meat, laying the eggs, and that's the origin of it. Louis Pasteur, we learned this in elementary school. He proved this to be the case. He took meat and put it in a jar and covered it, and he put meat and put it in a jar and left the lid off to where the flies could get to it. And lo and behold, the meat without the lid had maggots because of the flies laying their eggs on it. He said, no, the meat isn't giving rise. This is from the flies. And we know enough now that you throw dirty clothes in the corner. It's not, the mouse didn't come from the dirty clothes. The mouse was attracted to the dirty clothes or had a good hiding place there. It didn't give rise to it. That's the idea of spontaneous generation. And we're taught that in school. And I must feel a bit sorry for science teachers who in one breath have to teach lessons about the experiments that Louis Pasteur did and discredit spontaneous generation and say life does not come from non-living material. Louis Pasteur proved that, demonstrated that. We all know that. Spontaneous generation is not true. And then in the very next breath, when they changed to a chapter on the origin of life, where did we come from? Well, there were gases and things, and they all brought together us. In one breath, it's not true. In the next breath, that's the only way they can account for our existence. One man who was a scientist said, I know that spontaneous generation is not true, but it had to have been true at least once. And that was his statement. Who has forsaken reason and who has things to hide and be embarrassed of, being unscientific? It's not you who believe in God. It's those who have denied his existence and deny the evidences that are all around them. Another study is called the study of homology. Homology is a study of similarities, the study of sameness. And here's what people have said. Have you ever noticed that in, if you look at DNA, the DNA of an ape is very similar to the DNA of a human. And a similarity must mean that they're related because there's closeness, there's sameness, they're alike. And so there's this study that goes on where similarity means relationship. No, not at all. If do you remember when Dodge and Plymouth were, I don't know if they're still, Plymouth is making cars, I guess they're not anymore, but back in the day, we had a Plymouth Duster, but Dodge made a Dodge Demon. They're the same thing. They looked exactly alike. Now, is that because they had the same relative, or was that because they had the same designer? You see, sameness doesn't equate to we've got a common ancestor. Sameness or similarity can simply be accounted for by a common creator as well as a common ancestor. And even when you get into a study of homology, it doesn't fit the evolutionary process. We're told here's the way it progresses. And did you know that human DNA and turtle DNA is closer than that of apes? So do we need to rework that or do we just discard that? You see, who has forsaken reason and scientific thinking? There's another, this is a mouthful, punctuated equilibrium. Punctuated equilibrium, back in the day, and I'll explain what that means in a minute, but back in the day, there was a doctor in 1930 who said, well, Darwinian evolution says that there's going to be transition, one species evolved into another, and we'll find these transitional fossils where you got a half this and a half that, where they were making that transition from one thing to another. He said, we just haven't found them yet. This is in the 1800s. They thought they would find transitional fossils. They never have. They don't exist. And so in the 1930s, there was a doctor by the name of Goldschmidt who said, well, you know what? Here's what happened. It wasn't slow transitional changes. It was And he called his theory the hopeful monster theory. That one day an animal gave birth and something totally different emerged. It was just like that. Punctuated equilibrium. In other words, there's just these quantum leaps all of a sudden, overnight. It's like saying a lizard laid an egg and a bird flew away. You know, that's what he was trying to argue. People in the scientific community laughed him to scorn because of this hopeful monster theory. They too were sure, we'll find these transitional fossils. They haven't. And so now there's this, well, we can't call it hopeful monster. That doesn't sound very educated. So we call it punctuated equilibrium. And they believe today that certain things, a lizard laid an egg and a bird flew out of it. Just a quantum leap, a giant jump overnight. And that's how we came to be. You know, someone once said, I think I've heard that story before, but it involved a prince and a frog, you know? And isn't that basically what we're talking about? I mean, it's the same storyline. You got a frog that turns into a prince, and these are, this is some of the best scientific reasoning that we hear today. This is how it had to have happened. No, there aren't any transition fossils. The old slow evolutionary change that took place under Darwinianism, we don't believe that anymore. We believe in these quantum leaps because there's no evidence. And now they're embracing what amounts to little more than a fairy tale. And don't be ashamed of the position that you hold with reference to creation. There is a law of science called the law of biogenesis. That law of science says this: life comes from preceding life, and that of its own kind. In other words, for life to exist, it had to have come from life, not spontaneously generate. Life comes from preceding life, and it's always of the same kind. A mother is never going to give birth to a donkey. You know, it's never going to happen. A donkey is never going to give birth to a human. It's never going to happen. That would violate the law of biogenesis. It's a law of science. And yet, if you believe that there is no God and that everything happened through evolution, you have to deny the law of biogenesis and say that somewhere along the way, species have been crossed. You have to say life doesn't always come from preceding life, denying the first part of the law of biogenesis, and it doesn't always come from its own kind, denying the second part. Let me give you one more, and then we'll close the lesson. And this is the mouthful. Ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. What in the world? Boy, aren't you impressed? That's impressive. Ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. And here's what this is. Maybe you remember being taught this in school. What it means is that when a woman has a baby, when a baby is developing in the womb of its mother, if we had a window into that womb, when that baby first starts out as a little thing and gets bigger and bigger, it traces or retraces the evolutionary development of the human. Like there, and they would say, well, see, it has a tail. That must be from when it was a monkey, you know, and had a tail. And there's some gill slits on the side of its, on this embryo. And so that must be from when it was a fish. And they go through and they say that the development that takes place in the womb retraces the evolutionary development of man. And they'll lay it down in your science books. They'll have the embryo of a chicken and an embryo of a fish and an embryo of a human, and they show the similarities and how they change and where they start to diverge, and they say, see, that's ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. That's what we have. That's showing us how we came to be. I have a book in my library that belonged to my grandfather, my great-grandfather. And it was written by a man by the name of Ernst Haeckel. And it's about the evolution of mankind. And it's a two-volume book. And Ernst Haeckel came up with this theory. And he was discredited as a scientist because he forged the drawings to make them look the way he wanted them to look. In fact, those gill slits on the side of the human, when you look at the pictures, those aren't gill slits. Those are the beginnings of the inner ear. It has nothing to do with breathing. It has everything to do with hearing, and it was just developing. That tail in the early, that's not a tail. That's your backbone. You just haven't grown legs yet, and that's why it protrudes longer. All of that is just, it's just wrong. It's bad science. And yet I remember being taught this in school. But Haeckel was discredited for his fraudulent way that he went about trying to promote this theory. My point is this. You have nothing to be embarrassed for to say, I believe God created the heavens and the earth. That's not a leap in the dark. That is a statement that is built on evidence that cannot be refuted. Now, some people won't like that, but I'll tell you what you need to do. Don't be ashamed, and don't cower, and don't get silent because people don't like to hear certain things about God. You know, I have a suspicion that one of the reasons people don't like to hear about God is because it reminds them of a judgment. Do you remember what Paul, when he was talking to Felix, he said in the book of Acts, he said to Felix, you know, let me tell you about righteousness, self-control, and the judgment to come. And Felix said, I think I'll call for you at a more convenient time. We'll talk some more later. But let me tell you, did you know that when Paul said that to Felix, he had a woman that was not his wife with him. He had taken someone else's wife. Here he is, a man who has shown no self-control, and he's involved himself in adultery. And Paul doesn't beat around the bush. He says, I want to talk to you about righteousness, self-control, and the judgment to come. He addressed exactly what he needed to hear, and Felix didn't want to hear it. He said, go away, I'll call for you at a more convenient time. And I suspect that a lot of people don't want to talk about God because it reminds them there's a judgment to come, and it makes them uncomfortable. Folks, I don't mean to make people uncomfortable for the sake of meanness and twisting a knife, but I don't want people to get comfortable in their sin, because I don't want people to go to hell with a smile on their face. We need to warn people. There is a God, and there is a judgment to come. Acts chapter 17 says there was a time when God winked at a certain amount of ignorance, but now commands all men everywhere to repent. And he's appointed his son to be judge. The words that he has spoken, John 12 and verse 48, the words that he has spoken, the same shall judge you. He said, you can reject me and my words. And that's exactly where some people are today. I don't believe in Jesus. I don't believe in God. You can do that. You have the right, the choice to make is yours. But be it known that his word is going to judge you anyway. That's the message I want you to hear. I want you to be kind with people who don't believe in God. I believe there are people who don't really know, and they're confused, and they've sat under the feet of guys who said, if there's a God, strike me dead. I'm sure that there are people who are confused by that kind of thing. Be kind and diligent and be vocal and tell them there is a God to whom we must give account. There's a day of judgment. Show them the evidences that are there. Ask them to explain, how do you explain the design of the universe? How could this just happen? How do you explain the morality that we have, the sense of moral, the sense of moral oughtness, where you ought to do this and ought not do that? Where did that come from? And if it's just derived in our mind, then everything is up in the air. And why should, if it's just a matter of choice, why should I let you decide for me or anybody else decide for anybody else what they want to do? We are accountable to God, made in His image, and someday we'll go back to Him. I hope that some of the things that we've said tonight will be of help. Psalm 46 and verse 10, close with that. Be still and know that I am God. We can know that there is a God. Creation itself cries out to His existence. His special revelation of His word cries out to His existence. Don't deny the evidence. Don't turn away from rational thinking to what is offered that is irrational.